You're listening to
How Yoshi Did It
Podcast with Yoshi Obayashi.
Don't you ever all be sad. Lean on me when times get bad. When the day come and I know you die in a river of trouble, you're about to drown.
All right, I am in, am I saying that right? I'm at that St. Helena?
Saint Helena.
I'm always saying that wrong. And I'm probably saying your last name wrong. Amanda McCrossin, right?
Yeah, you got it.
Okay, great.
That's good.
So I'm here because our mutual friend Jason Buck and Jeremy, they're saying wonderful things about you, and you're an expert, in my opinion. I mean, very savvy about wine business, and a lot of people are like myself, pretty intimidated by it. So a little bit of background, where you're from and what you do here, and maybe you could educate the public not to be intimidated by wine business.
Yeah, well, it's funny because I actually got into the wine business because I was intimidated by it, but I'm originally from outside of Philadelphia.
Yeah.
I moved to New York about 6 years ago, and I was there for 5 years working as an actress and fell into the wine business. And from there, I started educating myself and learning about wine through a mentor that was an incredible sommelier from Le Bernardin and just in the New York wine world. So he started teaching me, and he took me under his wing. And very quickly, I decided that it was a passion I wanted to pursue. So I took that, and I went to a restaurant, and I was the wine director there for a year, and then I picked up and moved out here to Napa, and now I live in St. Helena, and I work at a restaurant called Press.
What did it exactly do? I mean, besides serving wine, but I know, I mean, in Japan, there's such a popular profession. There is even multiple comic books explaining public what they do. But
really?
How would you explain what they do besides, you know, recommending good wine to people?
So a sommelier's job is to, one, find great wines. Our job is to recommend great wines, and then our job is to serve the wines that they've ordered. So
okay.
it really does boil down to the basics of that. But beyond that, you know, we're tasked with, on any given night, finding a wine for someone who maybe hasn't had wine before. So
sure.
Any different palate, any different price point. But we're in hospitality. So
right.
Our job is to, you know, complete that entire cycle of a hospitable experience through wine. So it can mean many different things to many different people, but at the end of the day, the role of sommelier is to serve wine to a table, and it really is as simple as that.
And do you factor in, like, occasion of, you know, events and when?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, especially at Press, we are very fortunate to have a wine list that we do. So our specialty is old vintages of Napa wine.
Okay.
So all we serve there is Napa Valley wine. But that is a 1500 selection deep list of wine. So yeah, every now and then we'll have people come in and say, I want to drink my birth year. So
okay.
If you were born in 1968 or 1973 or whatever it is, then we'll say, okay, that's cool. You know, we'll find a wine from your birth year, or maybe there was an anniversary or a birth or whatever it is. You know, we'll try to find a wine that's meaningful and,
right.
and special for that person.
So, I mean, I don't even know how many wineries in this area. I mean, there's a lot.
There's a lot.
So how do you know what's good enough? I mean, besides tasting.
What's good to drink?
Yeah.
Oh, gosh, it's so personal. I mean, you know, if you're visiting the Napa Valley, it's like, you know, there's so many different experiences you can have. And part of what I'm tasked with doing at the restaurant is going out and seeking, you know, what the experience is like at a winery, what they're doing to make the wine, and then how that, you know, how that interprets into the wine
right.
as you're tasting the wine. So it's sort of a process that, you know, I can taste a wine and say, I like this wine a lot. And then my job is to sort of figure out what elements and what winemaking skills were associated with how that wine turned out.
I see.
So
you're almost like a talent scout when you go to different wineries. Like when you
sometimes,
you,
yeah. Yeah. And we're always looking for the next best thing, the newest, greatest wine. And that's kind of what makes it exciting. But there's a lot of wine in Napa. it takes a long time to get through it all.
Is there like a winery that like underrated that maybe more people should know?
There's tons of them.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, it's funny. When I moved here from New York, we don't see a lot of Napa wine in New York. It's a very European-centric area.
Okay.
So when I moved out here, I was completely overwhelmed because I was like, I don't know, like 50 to 60% of these wineries, and I'm supposed to know a lot more than that when I am in this business.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, there's a ton of underrated from, you know, entry-level boutique wines that they only make 4 barrels of, all the way up to 1,000-case production that just nobody really knows because it doesn't make it to Wine Spectator and Parker doesn't rate it, or they don't have worldwide distribution. So examples of that is like Seavey up in St. Helena. It was a really, really cool property that was purchased in 1979 by a family that lived here, and the father just kind of wanted to keep it in the family and didn't really do a lot of work to get the wine out there, didn't really do a lot of work to get people in the winery. Like, up until, I think, 2 months ago, they didn't have a sign. Like, nobody knew that it was even there, but we pour their wine by the glass because it's so spectacular and wonderful, and we love everything about it, and it's balanced, and it's definitely one of those under-the-radar wineries and wines that we love to recommend to people.
What do most Europeans think about Napa Valley's wine?
They're coming around, but it's funny, like, you know, the French still very much have their nose up at it.
Yeah.
But I think they're curious. I mean, I have more and more people come in and say, okay, well, we don't really know a lot about Napa, but here's what we like. And they'll tell me, you know, some French wineries that they like, regions that they like.
Right.
So we'll try to find things that are in their wheelhouse of things they already like. The Swedish love Napa wines.
Why is that?
I have no idea. I have no idea. It's the weirdest thing. And we've noticed it, or at least I've noticed it in the last year. They come in and they like big, powerful, intense, dense, fruit-forward wines, which for me, I mean, I always consider the European palate to be a little bit more sensitive to those things. So the Swedish are like totally gung-ho for these big, opulent, Harlan, Scarecrow, Realm, Camus-esque wines. It's kind of funny.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
My friend Adil, he's Pakistani, but he was raised in Sweden, and they have a restaurant called La Cucaracha in Sweden. And I remember 2 years ago he came to the States because one of the wineries insists selling all their wine through their restaurant.
Mm.
And they're so aggressive about making sure they buy their own wine only, you know.
Mm.
So I never realized how competitive it was. And it does seem like, you know, 25, 30 years ago, things that I was reading of Napa Valley, I mean, Europeans seem like they feel like they're superior, but
I think
that has changed quite a bit, I would imagine.
I think it has. I think, you know, from 76 on, when that big Judgment of Paris tasting happened, do you know about that?
No.
So in 1976, it was called the Judgment of Paris, and it was this big thing that happened in France every year. And in 1976, California wineries won the competition over the French wineries. And it was this like big thing. And it was the first time that put California on the map. French were stunned, like jaws dropped. And it was the first time that people really took California wine seriously. There's a lot of, it's taken a lot of time.
Right.
But, you know, once you start having things like that happen and happening over and over and over, you know, eventually they're going to come around. You know,
right.
Their palates are not always going to say, I want Napa Cab.
Right.
But they're interested and they're curious and they want to know what's out there. And the winemaking is getting better and better and better every year. And things are changing here. So, you know, I think Europeans they're coming around. They're a little less snobby about it than they were before.
I see.
Yeah.
So, What I mean, I don't want to say typical day, but what does your day consist of usually, you know, your job?
Yeah. Well, my personal day, I will generally visit a winery a few times a week, a different winery. And then.
So you've been doing that for about a year now?
Well, yeah, I mean, consistently over the last like 6 months.
Okay.
Because when I got here, I was still like acclimating myself and, like, you know, a New Yorker to rural California is like a huge change. But yeah, I mean, like, I'd say like for the last 6 months, so I've hit probably, I don't know, between 50 and 100 different wineries.
Wow. Okay.
Which is a lot considering how many there are. So yeah, so I'll visit a winery in the day, tasting. If I'm not visiting winery, I'll try to taste other wines during the day. I am still studying for my level 3 exam, so my advanced sommelier exam.
It's licensed?
So there, okay, so there's lots of like certifications for this. So if, you know, people are more familiar with the Court of Master Sommeliers, which is what that movie Somme was about.
Yes.
So that's the Master Sommelier. So that's level 4.
Is that the highest?
That is the highest. Okay. That is, there's only like 240 people in the world ever to get Master Sommelier. And it's incredibly prestigious, and the pass rate is less than 5%. I mean, you could study your whole life literally and never get Master Sommelier.
Who runs the organization? Like a French people? Or
no, it's an American organization called the Court of Master Sommeliers.
Okay.
And yeah, I mean, it's made up of a group of sommeliers that say, you know, these are the standards by which we say sommeliers can live by or serve wine by. So that's what this whole movie, Somme, has been based on is, and then there was a series on Esquire called Uncorked, and it was following a couple sommeliers in New York going after that as well. But it's incredibly difficult. There's a lot of components that people don't realize go into, you know, becoming a certified or advanced or master sommelier. It does, you know, you don't need those certifications to be a somm, but, you know, it's kind of like, getting your graduate degree, you know,
right.
It's just a little bit more education. It's a little bit more money under your belt, you know, for sure.
So you're going to level 3. So what was the first 2 tests were like? Is there like a lot of memorization or?
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, wine is like one of those subjects that, you know, I always say it's a bottomless pit of information.
Right.
Like it never ends. So you're educating yourself on geography, geology, climate, history of wine, wine laws, wine regions, grapes, winemaking processes, and then you have to taste. So now I have to put all of that information that I've learned into tasting a wine. And then, so you're tested when you go through the Court of Master Sommeliers, you're tested on theory. So all of those things that I just talked about. So it's anything that could be related to wine.
So there's a written test.
Okay. There is a service exam. So where you're actually like conducting a like a wine service. And you're being asked questions verbally doing that too. It's incredibly intimidating and terrifying. And then there's a blind tasting exam.
What is that considered? Like, is it like you taste it, you're supposed to tell them who made it, what year? And
kind of, yeah. So you're in the advanced exam and then the master exam as well. You're given 6 wines and you have, I think it's 25 minutes to conclude the region, the varietal, the potentially producer, and the vintage.
But how do you know? I mean, it just boggles
my
mind.
Okay, so there are certain markers for wines. So, you know, Chardonnay always has like notes of apple, and it can be, you know, it can be made with oak, it can be made without oak. You know, things that are a little bit more ripe in style, we'll say are New World. Things that are less ripe and a little bit more higher in acid are Old World. So you're literally deducing from information that you have. It's kind of like being a doctor, right? Like, patient comes to you with symptoms and you're like, all right, I'm going to take everything I know from my entire encyclopedia.
Right.
And I'm going to whittle it down to the most probable answer that I can come up with. And that's kind of like what it is to blind taste a wine. Like, you're basically taking the entire planet and you're tasting the wine and you're like, well, it can't be X, Y, and Z. So it could be A, B, C. So now how do I figure out if it's A, B, or C? And there's a lot of different factors that go into that. So, you know, we look for markers of varietal. We look for likely vintages. We look for likely producers. And you have to do it 6 times.
Rough estimate, what year? Did they even ask?
Yeah, no, totally. Yeah, you need to know, like, so initially you start with, like, all right, I think this wine is about 10 to 15 years old or 20 to 30 years old. And then you have to hone in on precise vintage, and for master you've got to nail that vintage because there's vintage variation in wine. So if you say a wine is, you know, presenting with like riper characteristics of a hot vintage, but you say a cool vintage. Well, you got that wrong. So it's there's a lot. You have to think about a lot when you're blind tasting. You've only got like 2.5 to 3 minutes per wine to do it.
So you've done that before with six wines. Let's
yeah.
give an example, six wines. Do they tell you how many you got it right about?
No. Well, indirectly. Like, you kind of have to... No, they never really give you, like, your answers at the end of the exam, but they tell you sort of, like, you maybe missed, like, the old world and mistook it for new world.
Okay, but in sex, how many do you have to get right about...
To pass?
Yeah.
I don't know how many it is. Because it's kind of, like, it's cumulative, so there's three components.
Right.
So I think it's... I mean, I want to say it's, like, 70% you have to get right. Which is a lot. I mean, you can go back and forth between the
sure.
wines, but it is to me like the most nerve-wracking 25 minutes of your life.
Right.
And it goes by like that because you're trying to like smell and taste and see and like try to get everything else out of your mind besides the wine.
Right.
So it's a crazy, crazy process.
And how long are these tests usually?
Well, the level three exam is taken over the course of a day, but the four, the
yeah.
master's only exam, you have to pass theory first, and then you can take your, the other components, the service and the blind tasting component, and that takes place over the course, I think it's like 3 days, and it's usually done in Aspen at the Little Nell or in Texas.
Wait, when you say service, there's like a fake customer. And,
yeah.
I see.
Oh, it's
there's
crazy.
Judges are standing watching how you do it.
The judges are at the table.
Okay.
It's your customer or your client or whoever is
yeah.
like sitting at the table, and they'll say, you know, we're having scallops and chicken and fish, and we would like a wine. What can you suggest?
I see.
And then they'll be really like intentionally difficult to the psalm. Like they'll say, but we don't like Riesling and we don't like champagne, which would be like the likely pairings for that, right?
Right.
So then the psalm is like, okay, well. Maybe you would like a Chablis, and they're like, "Great, what producer?" And you're like, Rousseau.
Yeah.
Right. So like, you go with that, and then they're like, "What producer? What vintage? How would you serve that? What glass would you serve it in? We don't really want that, actually. So give me something else."
I see.
So they'll just kind of like trip you up in many, many different ways, and they'll say, "Well, we want a cocktail first," and it's crazy stuff.
And I know you're going to pass this thing, but how,
no, not necessarily.
But how much time do you would you wait before you go the next level? Like, do they tell you, like...
Between 3 and 4?
Yeah.
Like years.
I see.
Like, I would... Some people go right into it. Like, some people will pass 3, and then, like, within... Like, they'll wait a year.
Yeah.
And then they'll go for 4. But most aren't... I mean, most aren't successful in general, and that's just... That's just an observation. That's
really, when it comes down to it, this sounds like what chefs go through when they're trying to get their Michelin star 1, 2, and 3, right?
Totally.
I mean, it's got to be stressful.
It's insane.
Yeah.
And all you do is study, like, day in, day out. Well, you should totally watch this, like, this documentary and watch this series on Corked, because it is really eye-opening. Like, you really get to see what it's like to be
yeah.
studying for that level of exam. And there's no other exam in the world like it. I mean, you're really just your flashcards, maps, quizzing each other, tasting it. It never stops. It just never, it is so comprehensive. You cannot even wrap your mind around it, because the second you think that you have learned everything,
right.
there's something else. You miss something.
So is that one of those things that you have? You pass level 4, but like, do you have it for the rest of your life, or you
yeah.
have to do something?
No, like, if you're level 4, like, and that's the beauty of this, right? So people will study forever to get this, because once you get that pin, and you get a pin, once you get that, you're golden. Like, you're set for life.
So I have to say, the Michelin star situation is more stressful, because you might have 3-star this
but
year,
but you can lose it. Correct. Yeah.
I mean, can you explain to the listener? Because that to me is nerve-wracking. I mean...
Losing a star?
Yeah, I think these guys, once reach 3-star, it's not permanent. Like, they
no.
can lose it.
Yeah, they can lose it. I mean, and they can lose it for reasons that, like, that aren't even their own. You know, they can lose it because
the
someone...
Servant
right, because someone, like, front of house, like, served the wrong wine or didn't place the napkin in the right,
right.
spot, or, you know, it can be completely arbitrary as to, you know, why they would lose a star. But yeah, I mean, you can work your entire life for your 3 Michelin star restaurant, and most restaurants don't keep their stars. Like, there's so few that have retained them. You know, even in New York, like, the greatest restaurants have, like, Danielle lost a star. That's a huge deal for a restaurant like that, that worked their entire lives. But it's also, you know, it keeps you on your toes, right? Like, that's actually, I think that's a good thing. I think we should all be kept on our toes to say, okay, at any you got your stars, but at any given moment, you're susceptible to losing them. And that's a really, that's a great thing for a restaurant to kind of always be on the cutting edge and making sure that you're, because people spend their entire lives waiting to go to these restaurants. Most people, you know, when they save up their money, they want that 3 Michelin star experience. If that restaurant is rated that, you know, if it slips, then, you know, they're using this guide that really isn't anything more than an old encyclopedia that hasn't been updated in 10 years, you know?
I remember one of the first trips, when I was here, Jason was kind enough to take us to French Laundry.
Wow, that was nice.
No. Just to go, walk around.
Oh, walk.
Yeah. I wasn't even there.
That's expensive.
But there were so many visitors. They were just awed by that place.
Yeah.
And it's a three... I mean, I don't know how many times in the last 20 years it's been ranked the best restaurant in the United States, right? I mean, multiple times.
It has. It actually... it's been... It's gone through... It's had some issues in the last few years. So Thomas Keller owns the French Laundry. He also owns Per Se in New York.
A giant, right?
Giant. Like, the giant in the culinary world in the United States. Like, I would... You know, he and Daniel Boulud are the two, like, big giant powerhouses here.
Right.
And now Daniel Hum of 11 Medicine Park. Anyway, Thomas Keller... owns a French Laundry, as well as Bouchon, and which is in LA, it's in Vegas, it's here. There's Bouchon Bakery in New York. But Per Se had a really, really interesting thing happen. They had been consistently 4 stars from the New York Times, and recently had got reviewed and got 2 stars. I mean, that's like bistro level stuff. You know, you've gone from 3 Michelin star quality down to something that's, you know, a little more casual and less finessed. And French Laundry, you know, I think, you know, it will always be the pinnacle of fine dining in California and in America. And it's, you know, it's synonymous with the greatest. But, you know, even French Laundry is susceptible to slips and falls. And they have had to work harder in the last few years to really make sure that they're still giving excellent quality fine dining experience. Because it's, one, very difficult to get a reservation, and two, very, very expensive. You're not getting out of there for less than $1,000 for 2 people.
Oh, my God.
It's a lot of money for dinner or for lunch, you know, and that's a pretty entry-level experience you're having. You know, that's not the finest of the wines. That's not, you know, all of the supplements that can be offered. That's a pretty, like, that's minimum. So it's up to that restaurant to really make sure that their quality is up to standard.
And by the way, it's called French Laundry because it used to be literally a French laundry.
Yeah.
They made a restaurant out of
it.
And it was exciting when I was there because I saw these young kids. They were so happy to work there for free.
Totally.
You know.
Isn't that crazy?
And to have that in their resume, it's just an incredible experience for them, you know. And there were so many Japanese. They were just so happy that they were able to stand in front of the restaurant and take pictures.
Yeah.
How much it means to those people. So,
So,
I mean, what is your? I know you're working so hard. You have so many great videos, Instagram. I mean, you're very savvy, and I think you're doing a wonderful job educating the public. And you know, for me and my friends, I think it's so intimidating. But I forget, you guys are here to make people's lives better and just have a wonderful meal.
Yeah.
And have a great conversation, and I think wine is a big part of that. So. I would highly recommend, don't be scared, come here, and you guys are very helpful. You really want people to have a good time.
Oh, yeah. I mean, here's the thing to think about, right? So, Psalms are getting younger and younger, and we didn't come out of the womb knowing how to taste wine or what wine was, right? So, like, this is only within the last few years that I've learned all of this.
Right.
So, at some point, like, unless you're the son or the daughter of some great winemaker... Like, we were all in that same boat. Like, nobody knew about wine. So, you know, when you come into the restaurant, just, you know, don't be intimidated by the psalm. Like, we are genuinely there to help you. We are hospitable human beings that want to make sure that you have the best experience you possibly can at whatever budget that is.
Right.
So if you have $20 to spend on a glass of wine, or $50 to spend on a bottle of wine, or you have $5,000 to spend on a bottle of wine, whatever it is, I'm going to make sure you have the best possible experience at any price point, at any level, whatever you're looking for.
Sure.
We're finding the best, because I don't want to sell you a bottle that, like, you're going to hate. That's a terrible feeling to make someone disappointed.
Do you also help them, like, if investors, I know that they want to buy wine for investing. Is that something that you help people purchase? Or?
I haven't. It's not something that I've dabbled in. I've looked into doing it.
Okay.
That's a different ball game. And it's, you know, I don't know if that's something that I'm interested in doing, because it's so far away from hospitality.
Right.
But it's, you know, it's not off the grid. But that's like investing in art, right? Like,
right,
that's
yeah.
art for the sake of money and not art for the sake of art. And it's kind of the same with wine. Like, if you're investing in wine, you're doing it because you want to turn a profit.
Sure.
Not because you
want
to enjoy it. Which is fine.
So I'm sure some of them probably want to come up. Which restaurant do you work for?
I work at Press.
Okay.
Yeah, so Press is in St. Helena. And we've been very fortunate to be on the short list for James Beard Award Best Wine List for the last, like, 5 years.
Okay.
We just got World of Fine Wine top, like, the Grand Tier Award for Best Wine List. So we've gotten some pretty serious accolades, which is nice. But it, you know, even a restaurant like Press, and even a wine list like Press, we're susceptible to, you know, slipping. So
right.
we're always making sure that we are on top of our game, and always have, it's a well curated list, and we have options at many different price levels and vintages for everyone. And, I'm very fortunate to work where I do. I mean, Press is an incredible place with an incredible wine list. Just a stellar reputation in the valley. So,
and what would you, what's your long term plan? I mean, would you like to own a restaurant, or?
No, oh my gosh, no. I have no desire to own. You know, like, how difficult it is to own a restaurant. I can't. I couldn't do it. It's just it really, like, sucks it out of you. No, restaurant owning is not in the foreseeable future for me. I like what I'm doing right now. I like. Like, you've seen these YouTube videos that
sure.
I do. So all of these wineries I go to.
And you're kind enough to give away free wine every Monday.
I do. Well, yeah. In the summer months, it's going to be like once. It's a little bit more sporadic.
Okay.
But yeah, it's called Case of the Mondays. And I give away a case of wine to an Instagram follower on, just for fun.
And my friend Sasha Gray says she will take a picture and everything. And she's just waiting for the special occasion right
yeah.
now. Yeah. But she's definitely coming up, because she's really curious about, you know, learning more about it. And I basically told her, and what do I know? But it seems like this is a lifetime endeavor, right? I mean, you could learn.
It never ends. Truly, like what I said before, it is a bottomless pit of information. There is no end to learning about wine, because there's always a new vintage. There's always a new producer. There's always a new up-and-coming region. And for somebody like Sasha Gray, I think it's awesome that she's, like, wanting to learn about wine. I think I sent her a Cru Beaujolais, which is by far my favorite, like, go-to drinking wine. So Beaujolais is a little sidestep from Burgundy. People think of Beaujolais as, like, Beaujolais Nouveau, which is pretty rancid and disgusting, but
I'm acting like I know.
Yeah. So Beaujolais Nouveau is a something that comes out like at the end of November, and they only sell it for like 3 months, and it's bottled young, and it's like a celebratory thing, but it's more festive than great drinking wine. But there's these crus in Beaujolais, these like certain areas that have distinct mm-hmm. soils, and the wines are made with a little bit more love and care than
right.
Beaujolais Nouveau. And they are elegant and beautiful, and not as expensive as Burgundy. So it's a way to experience great, great winemaking in that general vicinity without spending thousands of dollars. So, like, Jason and I will often buy Cru Beaujolais to just enjoy, like, with chicken or, you know, something easygoing.
I definitely have to recommend my friends and family if they... I think they're planning to come back to California soon. Like my friend, Dr. Shima, he is attorney in Japan. I met him, oh God, 15 years ago in Seattle because he was writing a text in Japanese explaining American legal system. But I met his sister. I think his sister was first or second Japanese to get certificate of French cooking. And she was living in Cannes. And she'll make all this amazing meal, and she speaks fluent French. And Japanese, you know, they definitely respect French cuisine. And I didn't know this. Vanity Fair recently, they were saying that there's actually more 3-star restaurants in Japan than France.
Is that true?
Yes, it's a Vanity Fair. They were
I didn't know that.
And there's like a mutual admiration because aesthetically speaking, Japanese love French art, and French for sure, especially during the Impressionist period, like Japanese art and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But that amount of effort and creativity in cooking and wine, you know, it's, it's just incredible. The Japanese love French and food, and I think the French definitely like Japanese food, but winery, boy, Japanese have a lot of respect for wine in Europe and Napa Valley. Dr. Shima used to make me go, because we were in Seattle, he would take me to Eastern Washington and all the different wineries, and what is the protocol when you visit winery? I mean, he knew everything about that, but I mean, what's some of the do's and don'ts when you visit winery?
That's a good question. Well, one, go with an open mind.
Okay.
You know, just like a restaurant, it should be a very hospitable experience.
Okay.
So part of having great hospitality is being a great guest. So being focused on what the either tasting room attendant or the winemaker, whoever's taking you through the experience. You know, I always think it's really important to listen and pay attention and ask questions.
Sure.
You know, to make it sort of a mutual experience. Don't get trashed. There's no need to, like, you know, be crazy and wild and, like, have fun, of course, but, like,
you're right, because
feel free to spit. Like, it's totally acceptable to spit your wine out and ask for a spit cup, which I don't think people realize. I think it's insulting to the winery, and it's not. Like, if you're tasting that many wines, it's expected that you'll be too intoxicated to really enjoy the wines.
I might have tried a couple, but ultimately I was the driver.
Mm-hmm.
So he just went nuts. We went to different wineries. But these days, thank God for Uber. Now you really could go different wineries and
totally.
Just go out and try as much as you can.
Yeah.
You know?
Or get a drive. I mean, yeah, definitely don't drive.
Yeah.
Hire a driver. There's great services in Napa for that. And please God, don't drive. Don't drink and drive in Napa.
Sure.
It's just so stupid. I always have a different experience than everyone else when I'm at a winery because of my job, because of being a sommelier, and then, of course, filming for YouTube.
Yeah.
But I always watch other people, and I try to see what they're doing and how they're experiencing the place. You know, if you don't like a wine, it's fine. Like, you don't need to drink it.
Sure.
But you should ask questions. Like,
right.
Ask, find out why you don't like that wine. So, you know, find out, you know, was it made in stainless steel or was it made in wood? You know, if it's a Sauvignon Blanc or is it Chardonnay? You know, if it's a Cabernet, like, ask how much time it's spent on oak. Maybe that's a clue as to what you like and what you don't like. And just start figuring out for yourself, you know, what you like. Because there's only so many things I can do as a somm to figure out what your palate likes and doesn't like.
See, I know you, so it would be easier. But like, if I didn't know anyone, I have no idea which one even to go first. You know, I mean,
in the lineup.
Yeah, because
there's no like wrong or right way to do it.
Okay.
I mean, some people swear, like most people will do whites and then reds, but some people swear by doing reds and then finishing with whites.
Okay.
the beauty about your palate is that it's constantly resetting itself. So your pH level is always, so you don't need to take a sip of water before you drink wine because your mouth is constantly resetting itself.
Okay.
Naturally. So that's one of the biggest misconceptions that people don't realize when they go to taste a wine and they have a sip of water first. That wine will actually usually taste a little bit more acidic in your mouth than it is because your mouth is still trying to reset and it's like producing more saliva, and more saliva means more acid. Sorry, it's kind of gross. So yeah, don't take a sip of water beforehand. But like, go back and forth between the wine. You know, it's like food. You know, there's no set direction you have to go. Just go with whatever feels right. And if you want to revisit like that Sauvignon Blanc after you have a cab, like, go for it. Who cares?
Okay, for restaurant, obviously go to where you work.
Yes.
But if somebody's visiting for the first time, you know, if you have to recommend four or five of them, what would you recommend? Like, you know,
like classic Napa experiences.
Yeah.
Frog's Leap is, I think, by far like my favorite classic Napa experience.
Why do you like it so much?
I think the wines are great. They are still very reasonably priced. John Williams has been making those wines since the 80s. It sits in Rutherford, and it's a beautiful, beautiful property. Has a wraparound deck. It's a very relaxed experience.
Okay.
So, like, the tasting room attendant will come around and pour you wine, and they'll answer questions. Then they leave you, which is, I always think it's nice, because then you can think about the wine or talk about the wine or not talk about the wine, whatever you want to do. But it's so classic and beautiful, and the wines are great, and they have a lot of different varietals, and I think they're all what we would consider varietally correct. So it's a good way to find out if, like, maybe you don't really like Sauvignon Blanc, maybe you like Chardonnay, or, you know, tasting a Zinfandel that really tastes like Zinfandel, it doesn't taste like something else because something else has been added to it. So Frog's Leap, for sure, is one of my favorites. If you want like an elevated experience, I'm trying to think where I've been recently that has been really cool. God, so many of these are like closed to the public.
Is that right?
Yeah,
you have to get an invitation, or
yeah, like wineries like Harlan and Bond are really hard to get into, and Donna, which is a Korean-owned place. Oh, you know what's really great? Kenzo. That's a Japanese-owned winery, and he's
a big video game guy, right?
Yes, exactly, Capcom, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
How long has he been around, that winery?
I think like 10 years. They started building that property. It's in the Wild Horse Valley, so it's pretty far from here. It's like a 40-minute drive.
Okay.
But it's beautiful. Howard Backen, which, like, if you're in Napa, you'll hear that name a lot. He was the architect for the place. David Abreu planted the vineyards, and then Heidi Barrett makes the wine. And Heidi was the one who, in the early 90s, was making Screamy Eagle and Del Valle Maya, which are those big, like, 100-point Parker wines. So she's still got her footprint all over the valley, but she makes Kenzo. And that's a beautiful sort of elevated tasting experience. If you want higher end wines and are willing to pay the price for it, I think that's a great place. As well as Rudd, which is actually the same owner as Press, and a little bit closer if you don't want to drive all the way up to Wild Horse Valley.
Have you met him before?
Kenzo?
Yeah.
No, I think she said he only, like, he's here like once a month, once every 2 months. No, I've never met him, but I'm sure he's great.
I mean,
he's very into wine. My understanding is that he's got one of the most impressive cellars, and he's into like everything from first growth Bordeaux to Grand Cru Burgundy to Napa, like cult Napa cabs.
Okay.
And they do a great job there. It's the only Sauvignon Blanc that Heidi Barrett makes. And they make everything in half bottle, which I think is nice for like those of us that are a little bit more non-committal.
Okay, so that's two. Give me like three more.
Okay, CV, what we talked about earlier, great like old rustic experience. If you don't want to come over to Napa Valley and you want to stay in Sonoma, Scribe is awesome. Very, very relaxed. What else do I really like? Gosh, there's so many of them in the valley.
The Coppola family,
Coppolas.
I'm so biased. You know, yeah. I just love the guy. So yeah. I didn't taste wine, but I was just so happy to see some of the photograph of movies and things like that. I mean,
it's like Disney World there, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, Coppola.
What? How? I mean, have you tried his wine before? And
yeah. It's good. You know, he's a very passionate guy about what he, like, everything that he does. So there's just, there's a lot of wines. So some are really great and some are misses, you know, or just not my palate, I should say. God, yeah, that place is kind of crazy. That's a cool place if you've got, like, your family in Napa.
Yeah.
And you don't want to be tasting wine all day. Like, go to Coppola. They've got a pool there, and it's very interesting. It's a cool place, though.
And I remember, once again, you know, I'm a big fan of Vanity Fair, but yeah. I think within a month or two, they were talking about winery in Italy where his father's from, and some of the reference to Godfather was made, and it was really interesting. He went back, and it's really, I wish I could remember the town, but it's really out of the way from a touristy area. So, yeah, that family is incredible. I mean, just they're just so creative and talented in so many different fields.
Yeah.
Directing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And they, you know, they're still very much in the Napa Valley, and Eleanor Coppola still lives in the valley, and there's always, like, Coppola's, like, running around here. This, like, you know, this town is crazy. Like, as farmer as it is, there's constantly celebrities and so much money walking around here. It's a very interesting juxtaposition.
In addition to entertainment, of course, you probably have a lot of Silicon Valley.
Yeah. We got a lot of Silicon Valley, Marin County, San Francisco Bay Area. And then we got a lot of people from, like, L.A., from, like, Southern California that come up. And then Texas is...
So is the climate, like, comparable to that places in France? Is that why they picked this?
No, you know what's crazy? Like, this place is, it's way hotter than France. I mean, at least,
it,
like,
is?
Yeah, I mean, like, at least for the varietals that we're doing, yeah. Okay. But, you know, there's been climate shift, and, like, some seasons are more warm than others. The beauty about Napa Valley is we have this, like, this diurnal shift. So this crazy drop in temperature at night. So in the daytime, you know, well, like today, it's like 100 degrees outside, right? So it's so brutal, which is maybe a little bit too hot for the grapes.
Right.
But usually, like, it's a pretty consistent 85 to 90 degrees, which is great. And then at night it shuts down, like it goes down to the 60s or 70s, so the acid can kind of come back to the grapes and sort of balance everything out.
I see.
Yeah, I mean, Napa Valley is great for grape growing, but it's different than France. The soils are different, the climate is different. It's, you know, there's more humidity over there. We've got dry everywhere. It's like drought season, and we finally got a little rain, but, you know, we've got major water issues here.
So your job really is not only customer service, history, art of wine,
mm-hmm.
but you seem to know a lot about science, like the chemistry.
You have to, yeah. I mean, like I said, you know, at the end of the day, we can boil our job down to we serve wine. But in order to be really good at your job, you've got to know all of these different components. So when someone asks you a question about, you know, why does this wine taste different than this other wine? Well, there's a couple different reasons. You know, it's winemaking, it's chemistry, it's science. You know, it's all of these different components. And if you're a good sommelier, you'll know the answer to that question, or you'll find out, or you'll have some sort of educated guess into why that is.
So, beside Napa Valley,
yeah.
I know the powerhouses, I guess, in Europe, France.
Mm-hmm.
What other part of the world, like, up and coming winery? Is Asia any factor at all, or?
Well, I have yet to taste anything out of Asia. I know the Chinese are making wine, and I haven't had it yet. I've heard okay things.
Okay.
Like, Asia is a huge continent. Like, there has to be somewhere to make decent wine out of there.
Okay.
I just haven't seen it yet. So I can't say for sure if it's up and coming. People love South Africa. I am still not convinced. I haven't really tasted anything I love.
Okay.
Australia, people write off because some major conglomerates have made wine out of there, and it's become a little bit more like grocery store.
Yeah.
But Australia was actually in the forefront of winemaking technology. So, you know, you've got beautiful, beautiful wines coming out of Australia and then New Zealand as well. But the best part about Australian wines are the technology is so good that there is so much consistency from wine to wine. because they're not really skimping on in that area. So while the wines may not be as like artistic or beautiful,
yeah,
like if you're looking for a $15 to $20 bottle of wine, just go Australian. Like it's gonna be good.
I never thought
yeah
winery when I think about Australia.
No, there's beautiful, there's like very expensive wines coming out of Australia. So Shiraz is one of their grapes, and it's the same thing as Syrah. It's just it's a synonym. But yeah, Australian Chardonnay, Australian Shiraz, Australian Cab. There's beautiful Semillon coming out of there. And then New Zealand's great for Pinot Noir and Sauvignon Blanc. Like beautiful, wow, beautiful wines coming out of there. Very expensive wines. And then South America is like the big up and coming region that people are really pushing. So Chile and Argentina for sure. And, you know, Argentinian Malbec has been around for a while, but Chilean wines are up and coming, and they're very, very, undervalued right now.
I think I have maybe 4.5-5 minutes. I just want to make sure I
yeah
give them a chance for you to tell your Instagram and how they could contact you. And
battery's, yeah,
battery's about to go dead on me. So
all right. So we'll be quick.
Go on.
Yeah. So on Instagram, I'm at Somm Vivant. So kind of like Bon Vivant. SOMMVIVANT. And then on Instagram, it's the same. Or on YouTube, it's the same. So it's Somm Vivant on YouTube. And I put up new videos of all of these wineries I go to at least once a week, if not more.
And giveaways on Mondays.
Oh, Case of the Mondays. Yeah, Case of the Mondays on Monday. You have to follow me on Instagram and turn on your notifications so you know. But Sunday night at like midnight, I will post the Case of the Mondays giveaway. You have to be over 21, of course, and then
yes
live in the United States. But I will pick a winner at the end of the day on Monday, and they will receive a case of wine.
And if they have a question, how would they just...
Yeah, you can contact me on Instagram or on YouTube, or you can email me. I'll give you my email.
Okay.
It's AmandaMacrossin@mac.com.
Can you spell your last
name? My last name? Yeah. It's MCCROSSIN.
And do you have a fixed schedule when you work? Maybe they want to go to the restaurant. And,
I don't have you know, we're closed on Tuesdays. I'm almost always there on the weekends, but I always encourage people to let me know when they're coming so I know to keep an eye out for them. So you can send me a message on Instagram or email me. And I'm pretty good at getting back to people.
Perfect. And
yeah,
of course, if you're up here, you definitely have to go and see Cameo Cinema and see.
Oh, yeah. I love the Cameo Cinema.
So have a nice movie, a meal, and, you know, Amanda will help you with wine.
Yeah.
And, well, thanks for doing this. You know,
thanks, Yosh.
Jason said, you know, they're just impressed with you. And you're so knowledgeable.
They're
and
so nice.
You're very kind, you know, because I think most people are just really intimidated by wine, and I think
we're trying to get rid of that.
You're educating the public and making it fun, you know,
yeah,
because working class people, they're not afraid of beer, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thanks. And I think Sasha, I definitely want to remind Sasha Gray to come up here for that movie festival you're talking
yeah
about. Late October, first.
Yeah,
October.
Napa Valley Film Festival is great.
Great.
It's a perfect
so
time.
Come up and enjoy the food and wine, and of course watch a movie at Cameo Cinema. And yeah, go say hi to Kathy Buck as well. But
yeah.
Amanda, thank you very much.
Thanks,
this is fine. And everyone, just make sure to follow her Instagram and YouTube. I mean, it's really fun to watch.
Thank you.
Thanks.